Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Reliability Gang podcast. I'm back with my right-hand man, Will Crane. How are we keeping, buddy?
I'm doing good.
We asked the question, what do you want to hear from us, right?
A long time ago.
Quite a while ago, 3 weeks ago. Okay, so we have been out of the mix, right? We've been fairly busy doing various bits as we are. And you guys have spoken and you've chosen AI and industry. And I'm so glad people chosen this because I have personally been on a little bit of a research R&D with this AI with myself and like listening to different podcasts. And I think you're the same, Will. I think Will's the one who kind of said, oh, Will, there's this podcast, you need to listen to it. And I kind of listened to that and I'm like, oh my God, this is bad. Then I listened to another podcast, which is like polar opposite of my perception. I'm like, actually, AI could be a good thing. And now I've got all of these thoughts and what I'm trying to do is be able to make my own mind up about what it means and what it means for the future of our kids, us, technology, our business that we've grown. So, you know, we've really worked hard to grow this business over years. And because tech is changing so fast, right? How does that mean that we need to pivot and understand where the future is? And me and Will have had endless conversations about innovation, innovate or die, the Bob Iger phenomenon in terms of what it is. And we're always trying to make things better. But what a perfect space for us to talk about this in depth, about the industry, and not even about the industry, just about it in general, and what our thoughts are on it, and maybe play devil's advocate with it a little bit, rather than seeing it. I mean, currently, I don't know about you, Will, a lot of the things I'm seeing is 80% negative. Oh my God, they're going to kill us all. There's going to be AI robots. They're taking our jobs. And there's been very little coverage on the benefits, where I want to kind of play devil's advocate now in terms of trying to understand how can it actually maybe benefit us if used in the right way.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. You want me to, I suppose I'll come in from my perspective of it. We originally kind of started this journey. I think the turning point was we obviously follow those that might be aware of Diary of the CEO, and he did a podcast. Stephen Bartlett did a podcast with another guy that me and Will have read his book, which was I'm trying to think of his name now.
Mo Gowdot.
So Mo Gowdot was has gone through various different careers, but he also was the, I think, chief business officer for Google X, which was all about a Google making a 10x improvement. So it was looking at really forward thinking,
game changing ideas about futuristic ways of tech.
But he was quite heavily involved with AI during his career, and he did this podcast with Stephen talking about how. And I think if you listen to the podcast, it can seem quite daunting, but that the message I took from it is fundamentally is AI is something that is coming, that has the, is going to be one of the biggest implications to the world. He talked about it in the podcast as an Oppenheimer moment from when the atomic bomb was developed.
I think this is what really kind of is getting people a little bit concerned, isn't it? And especially when I think when someone like Mo Gowdot, his experience,
there's a right to be concerned, because fundamentally it is quite a drastic change that's to come, and there does need to be a level of probably regulation around it. But if you take those things and with AI, he talks about this in the podcast, fundamentally AI on its own isn't dangerous, it's what humans decide to do with it. So if you take away and say, right, well, let's not worry about the things that bad humans are going to do with it, because unfortunately, in the position we're in, probably can't really change that. It's going to have to come from government. But look at the things that AI is going to potentially do that is going to be great for everyone and in industry.
Yeah, and what it can,
that's the exciting bit that excites me.
I agree. And as well, I listened to a podcast saying, Diary of a CEO, but it was with will.i.am.
Yeah.
And will.i.am has always been a very cool and futuristic. You can see it in his brand and who he is, and the way he like performs his music. His studio is like a spaceship. I don't know if you've seen the studio. No. It's like literally he's on the Star Trek deck,
really,
with mixing desks. And he is a person that he, even on the podcast, said he's always living 10 years ahead. But he's saying that he's in that futuristic point of view, so he can help humanity from the viewpoint of what is in the future and how that can help now. Do you know what I mean? Because I think it within the podcast, he says he kind of come from humble beginnings and all the rest of it. And he said that it was a struggle growing up. It was difficult for him to be able to, you know, get studio time and be able to do what he wanted to do. But he wanted to be able to express himself creatively. And he's such a futuristic person. He's, you know, a music innovative guy. His studio is like in a spaceship. He's just such a forward thinking person. I think he's like very much into tech, very much into like blockchain, very much into like futuristic ways of making life easier. Do you know what I mean? Because he comes from struggle. And I think one of his like purposes and whys is to be able to, how do we make things easier? How do we like express ourselves creatively, but are able to do it in a way that is to be able to reach more people, but we can create more by making things more efficient and stuff. And he has actually got platforms and apps, and I'm not actually entirely sure what the purpose of these apps are, but one thing I do believe that he's involved with is the idea that who owns the rights to the creation of the AI things that are created. So say, for example, you use AI to create something and then you piece loads of AI pieces together and you create something authentic or unique. How is that kind of owned by you when it was generated from a piece of software? And the idea of it is trying to understand, well, who actually owns it if it was generated by someone else? Who owns them copyrights? Mm. Does that make sense? Yeah. So say, for example, I do music and I release music every now and again. Say, for example, I created a bit of art album artwork by an AI-generated artwork piece, right? It might be able to spit out loads of alliterations of that, but do I own that artwork after I've created it from AI, or is there a percentage owned by the company that actually has created it? And this is where the grey area is going to become very difficult moving in the future.
For the creative side of things,
yeah. So I think what I loved about it was the flexibility to be able to create so much more, a lot more quicker. Do you know what I mean? In terms of what it is. But then he's now fighting to make sure that even the artists, if they do create something authentic from it, it's a bit like my music production software, right? There's AI built into different software packages in that. So say, for example, back in the day, you wouldn't have this type of synthesizer where you'd be able to drag like an icon to make a beat, for example. And then you can drag it to make it more punchy. You can drag it to make it more a beat. You can add some cymbals in. You can add some, and you can add some bass line. And you can just like click some buttons and it'll create the beat for you. It's a bit like AI generated music, right? That's very common nowadays. Most music that you listen to has been made that way, okay? But because it wasn't actually synthesized with a beat pad and, you know, all the rest of it, is that a creative thing? Well, I still think it is. Because if you piece it together creatively, you're still creating that. And if it's authentic from that creation or your idea of something, what is the difference of you actually beating it in opposed to moving a lever around to make it sound how you want it to sound?
I think, like, from an AI point of view, that I think obviously affects the creative industry quite a bit, but doesn't impact where AI comes into condition monitoring as much. I can't see that, because AI has many different, like, AI as a model is the ability for it to like self-learn, artificial intelligence. It's a more utilizing lots of data sets to be able to pull from, like ChatGPT, which is the one that everyone's heard of, is obviously pulling from the internet as its source of data and trying to learn along the way what that
is. So do you think that's where the danger is? The danger is not in the sense that these artificial intelligence programs allow us to do things fairly quickly and it can creatively automate these processes that we would take probably weeks to do. It's the fact of the self-learning capabilities within the program that may on its own right get out of control. Is that really where the fear is with it?
Yeah, effectively.
Is there nothing but that we can do to stop that if that was gone too far? Is that where the concern is?
Like Mo Gowdot in his podcast with Stephen Bartlett talks over several different potential circumstances. But if you've got an algorithm that's self-learning, then how do you stop it from learning how to prevent itself from being stopped? Like, you have to think of AI a real broad, like, topic of AI, which is you have to think of it as so much more smarter than we are.
Of course,
so like he talks about a circumstance where there's a robot and there's 10 of them and he walked past them every day and they're trying to pick a ball up, show it to the camera. pick the ball up, show it to the camera. And every time they miss the ball and they show they haven't got it, that you're teaching the model that that is not correct. So it tries again, tries again. Then eventually, after several months, one of them picks it up, shows it, oh, I've got the ball. And within the day, they were all doing it.
Wow. So they all so quick to that self-learning capabilities.
And he talks about it in, and this is where it gets quite exciting for condition monitoring as well, but he talks about it how this self-learning capabilities, it is very similar to how we teach ourselves and babies. So kids have those blocks, don't they, with different shapes, and they get the triangle and they put it in the square and it doesn't go in. Yeah. And then they do the circle and it doesn't go in. And so they keep doing it and then eventually it slots in. It gives that clicks. Oh, I've got it.
They start firing and wiring in terms of action, feedback, it's work, and then memory.
All AI is pulling from data sources and then building models that self-learn and replicate. So like, you know, when you go and do Google Recapture, and it's like, it wants to confirm if you're a human. And so what it does is it asks you to click all the boxes that have a bus in it.
Yeah, so annoying that, isn't it?
That is all for Google's visual recognition. That data is being harvested. It's for a password check, but the data itself is not just there for a password check. They're using that to feed into Google's self-driving cars. So all of those times that you as a human have said, that's a bus, that's a bus, that's a bus, they take all that data, put it into the car's AI model, and now it can suddenly recognize a bus because it's had millions of users pick out multiple different images and say it's a bus.
So in terms of, let's now correlate. So we've kind of touched on AI and kind of what it is and how it can be quite effective, how it can be quite efficient, how it could be potentially dangerous. Now looking at it in terms of vibration analysis or condition monitoring, it could be kind of any technique. Mm-hmm. The self-learning capabilities of, for example, a system or a sensor, would we now be able to be in a position and place where the sensor or the program will be able to learn machine conditions and understand repetitive events and understand anomalies within that and be able to accurately identify exactly what the problem is? Are we there yet in terms of that, in terms of where we're at with AI?
The technology is there. It's just not been commercialized yet in our industry fully. Like, it's still being developed, you know, Aquem of AccurX.
And we've played with AccurX.
You've got other places that are still developing. The technology is 100% there because ultimately, with anything with AI, as before, you've still got to be able to give it some sort of information. As if you just
if
you put two spectrums in front of an AI model built to detect problems within vibration spectrum, and you don't tell it anything else, it's not going to know.
It needs to have a goal, doesn't it?
But if you said to it, "This is the machine. This is where we'd expect the running speed. This is where we'd expect the fault frequencies." And over a period of time, you fed data into it and said, "This is okay. This is okay. This is okay." It would start to learn, "This is okay. And these are the frequencies I'm of interest in." And when it goes outside that range, it would consider it not okay. And then it could flag it and look into it. That's real basic, but fun.
But that's basic stuff that has been around for a long time, essentially. Like, understanding when shutter speeds, for example, banding out certain areas for certain fault frequencies, and then obviously the monitoring of that. But that is not necessarily machine learning, is it? Machine learning is understanding from a point of actually almost understanding the machine itself on its own capabilities without input into the machine. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it would gather the data over a period of time and start looking at it. You could do it that way as well. There's two approaches that I see in the industry at the minute. So you've got some companies, I don't want to name any names, that are going down the approach of, we give it information. If you do it that method and you give it, this is okay, this is what we would consider abnormal, keep checking the data.
So the danger of that would be for, shall we say, a run-of-the-mill condition monitoring company, that the information that is put in to be analysed could almost analyse itself if there was enough information there.
Yeah, if you think as a spectrum in total, like if you had a...
How much data though would be required to be able to do that? It would have to be more than like a monthly set of data. It would have to be something that is analysed pretty regularly for a band to understand the patterns.
I mean, like, if you, is it obviously, let's say you take a standard bassline machine, right? Let's look at it on a, not so much complex, because that's a bit complex, but you look at a standard motor pump and it's, let's say it's new and it's been running for about 6 months and it's green. We're happy with it. If you knew the running speed, the electrical frequencies, the bearings in the motor, whether it's got rotor bars, and you knew the rotor bar frequency, yeah, the pump bearing,
the force and frequency,
you knew everything that, yeah, was there, and you knew where they would appear in the spectrum, let's say it's fixed speed as well, then, and you put that in an AI model and said, look for these. If these appear, that's bad. If these appear, that's good. If they're above this, that's bad. Which is just a more advanced band alarm system, effectively. The difference is the AI is going, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a good. And it's only telling you where there's an issue. That's more than capable of doing that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's fairly, that's
the
fairly
difference
basic.
Is like you say, the machine learning part. Which,
this is what I'm interested in, though. This is where I really want to get the meat. Right, the machine learning element. Because we know there's systems out there, online systems, that we can tell the software what to look for.
Yeah.
We can tell the software what the running machine speeds are, what the fault frequencies are. We can do all of that now currently. That's not been anything new. But what I'm interested in is the ability to be able to understand the natural frequencies of the machine and the machine learning to be able to then understand on its own back whether that is normal or if that's damaging to the actual operation of that machine.
With the right programming.
Surely there'd be some sort of prompting that needs to be installed in that program to know what's good or bad. Or does AI have the ability to be able to monitor over long periods of time? But how does it know what's good or bad, if that makes sense? If there's no feedback in terms of what the effect of them readings could be.
With machine learning, you're still going to need to build a model.
There's got to be prompts
of what is considered good or bad. Right. The bigger the model is, the more accurate it becomes.
And I suppose as well, for every different machine, you're going to have to build that model, or someone's going to have to build it. Am I right? Or
or
would you then create, I don't know, a software program that takes into account all of the machines, if that makes sense, and then you kind of then input what machine, just a bit like you do with bearing fault information, it can then give you all of that. You might even have a software program that allows you to actually input the actual blower or the manufacturer model or the serial.
The more data you have, the more accurate your model becomes.
So this is really data-driven, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's got to be based upon a lot of information.
With your machine learning model, say that you could hypothetically, if you had just one factory, and that factory, I don't know, had 30 assets, pumps that were all identical, 30 that were another set that were identical, and 30 that were another set identical, which no factory really has.
No, this is just for example.
But if you had that, it could look at the data between all 30 pairs of identical machines and try and learn from each other, like, is this normal? This machine looks like this one. I've seen this before. That's okay. But it can only go, that's okay, by having someone go, that's okay. Oh, okay, that's considered normal.
So is this machine learning then?
It is over a period of time, because once
you've input that information, then it learns it's not, and then it learns from that.
It then builds its. But you have like
the two models.
But
that has to stop with the human interaction, though, in terms of the machine is only capable of learning once you give the feedback whether that's okay
or
wrong.
But this is why, right, when you consider the concern of AI, it still requires some human input to say, of badness, if that's a word, to trigger the right, cascade effect, right? That's why if you listen on Mo Gowdot's podcast, he's like, you know, AI itself isn't bad. It's how we decide
how
to use
it.
How
it is used.
Because the model still has to be built. The data still has to be inputted. And there still has to be some level of initial tuition as to say, because like in the ball example, someone has gone in and has coded that to do that and then has said, when you pick up the ball and you show it in the camera, if the ball is there, that's good. And if it's not there, That's bad.
Is that it's not going to program to say, well, if you can pick up the ball, chuck it at the nearest person in the room. It's going to chuck it at the nearest person in the room, isn't it?
Or even if it's said in the wrong way, which is that if you don't pick up the ball, that's the good thing. And if you pick it up, it's going to do the reverse of it. It still needs that
still needs
initial,
that human interaction. Yeah. That's very interesting.
So the danger that you could look from self-learning or we call it machine learning, but self-learning on AI model from what my understanding of it is the idea that what you could end up doing is saying to an AI model we want to solve the issue of climate change. And if it's got the right data and freedom to gather information from everywhere, it may conclude that the easiest way to solve climate change is to get rid of humanity.
Eliminate the problem at the source, which, you know, essentially is shall we say, a logical way but for the machine to understand.
There's another
there's
another AI example where they were trying to teach an AI a language. I can't remember what it was. I don't know, say Hungarian. You can Google it. I can't remember the details. And it learnt it, but at the same time, it also learnt German. But they can't work out how it suddenly worked out this second language. It self-taught itself to use similar techniques, I'm guessing, to learn this other language. But again, the language, ChatGPT, they're all if you took the internet away tomorrow, ChatGPT would fall over. It wouldn't work.
Yeah, because it's pulling the data source
from it. The difference, what all it's doing is when you search, hey, write me an essay in the style of, I don't know, Mozart, it's looking at how all the text that Mozart's ever written, and then it's looking at all the information you want it written, and then it's trying to compare.
It's phenomenal, though, how fast it pulls that data, though, isn't it? Mm. That's what gets me, how quick.
But they're all being run on supercomputers, aren't they?
I know, but it's still incredible how, like, I've been using some AI prompt and just playing around with, like, give me a strategy for this, give me a whatever, and it just how it writes it out is... It is genuinely like...
But that falls down into like computer science and how computer science works with like even I remember like when I did a computer science course ages ago. Just brush right over that. But effectively like the yellow pages, like obviously the way that a computer systematically finds the information in the yellow pages, like your phone number, it doesn't like... split it in the same way we would as humans go, is it here, is it there or not? It does it in a way, if I can remember rightly, it kind of like splits the book in half, checks one side, see if it's in there. If it's not, if it bins it off, gets the next one, splits it in half.
Efficiently cuts down the process of information, which is very smart. And I think this is where I see the future in terms of condition monitoring. I genuinely do, you know. In terms of technology, I mean, I remember when we first was quoting online systems, it was just painful to send a quote because the cost of and not even that, you had to wire everything in then. Like wireless technology wasn't really a thing when I first started into this game. I think there was a few alliterations of it, but they were very costly and they weren't the best of systems. I remember it was the SKF little indicators. So but they weren't wireless. They would just give you a flashing light. So it wasn't even wireless technology essentially, but it was battery operated. And you put it on and it would literally be green, amber, red. Whether there's an issue, it's like, oh, okay, red. Well, there's some form of issue somewhere. So I remember they were the first things, but they were quite expensive anyway, even what they were. And I remember a few sites were putting these things on and they were going red. And what was happening was, there was like, oh my God, we got to change this. And they were changing them out. And what they were finding, it was triggering red on a GE alarm and they were inverter frequencies. So it was a bit like, nothing wrong with it. Completely natural. You know, nice. You see inverter frequencies in the GE spectrum. And it was like, oh. Nothing wrong with this. And I think that was kind of the introduction of like, you know, the first alliteration of smart monitoring of like, okay, just quickly have a look at something. Is it wrong? Is there a problem? Shall we take action from it? And obviously that's not an effective strategy. But now we're moving into wireless technology. We're moving into lower cost sensors, lower cost technology. And the ability to be able to take more data is beautiful. I mean,
well, that's the key bit, because you look at like, machine learning, I think in the short term AI is going to be initially working off of this probably model of we're telling it the information that is good or what to look for. And then it's probably one of the issues at the minute with wireless sensors is bandwidth and being able to transmit all of that data, especially if you've got a plant with hundreds of sensors.
Yeah, so a lot of interference as well.
Yeah, so one way of getting around that is looking at, well, we're only going to send the data when we see an abnormality. Doesn't need to know what it is, it just
needs to know there's some trigger.
With that, in the short term, we're going to need to tell it, well, or create these bands where we say this is normal, this is not, transmit it only when that's the case. The difference is we're doing it in software and an AI model rather than band alarms. That's probably the short term. The long term is, yeah, we probably will go down machine learning, but that's only going to work when we've got a sufficient data pool of data and people able to just like how Google has captured data over years of people going, yeah, that's a bus, yeah, that's a car. That model within the vibration analysis world is yet to be created. We no one's gone and built a model yet that looks at vibration data, to my knowledge. I'm sure there's people working on it that has analysts all around the world actively saying that's an okay spectrum, that's not an okay spectrum. Once that starts getting built, then it can start self-learning itself. But
when that model gets big enough,
then it's easy.
There's no need to then keep input into it.
No.
Until you find new machinery or whatever. But by that point, if you're...
There's enough in there.
There'll be enough in there then to be able to actually then manipulate
what
needs to be manipulated.
And then it will start self-learning off that point as well. So it will start looking at the data and say...
And looking at trends and looking at...
It'll go, I've seen this before. Yeah, this is a bearing defect. And it might be that it might never get to a point where it is just actions it automatically. It might land on your desk saying, these are all my... Hi, I am the vibration AI. Here are my findings. And then you go through and go, yep, no.
Yeah, and then you can then maybe
just as a final vet. But that yes, no, that data is then getting fed back into the model.
And they're learning that again. Exactly. So it gets more sophisticated as it goes and as it grows and where it goes and becomes.
Yeah.
So I think this is where the future is going in terms of, you know, let's be honest, if we can put a sensor... Right, relatively low cost, and we can track good information now. And even the MEMS sensors, I know a lot of people have a lot of beef with the MEMS sensors or whatever, but the reality is they still can collect fairly decent data. Okay, it's not the best resolution, we know that it's not comparable to, you know, piezoelectric sensors. But the idea of being able to collect something and be able to identify when there is a change across mass data is a trigger. It is identification. So is it efficient anymore where we send actual people to go collect mass data collection when you can get more information off this sensor if it's a lower cost? I mean, let's be honest, what's driven us going out to collect data now? It's cost, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Of course it is. The only reason why we're out doing this, right, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of value on top of us going out on site. Right. And us guys will all tell you that in terms of visual inspections and checking oil and all the rest. There's a lot that a sensor can't do. Like that is, you know, that definitely is the case. And as well, in terms of maintenance, we know that a lot of the time when we do these VA surveys, we're relied upon as an extra layer of PPM checks as well, because we're actually getting paid to do a lot of that as well. Because what's happening right now? There's not enough people on site to be able to understand and look after everything. But when it comes from a purely data, you know, collection perspective, when sensors do get cheap enough, they will be doing the job.
The VA, not the PMs, maybe not
the inspections, but they will be doing a better job because it can. What? Why? Because we can collect more.
The cheap bit is kind of the more important thing to, I suppose, discuss, because at the moment there's a whole piece on culture change that needs to happen, and we need to move into the more forward, which is probably another discussion point. But at the moment, the cost for a small form factor MEMS based sensor that we see in the future being deployed across an entire site, for example, that is monitoring the data on a daily basis, pulling that information in, that cost has to reduce. It's not cost effective
to feasibly compete. with me putting a Falcon on someone to go across site and collect data and do observations. And this is, I still believe there's so much value in what we do, even on the handheld perspective, because there's a lot more to it. We don't just use VA either. We use an ultrasound. We're looking for other things where we are inspecting even air leaks. Sometimes you hear one on the way and you say, oh, there's an issue there, or there's an oil leak here. There's a problem here. So there's a lot of other, and I don't want to get attacked from this podcast in terms of this new way of thinking, because I have had to personally change my belief systems to be able to think about what the future holds. Does that make sense? It's not easy. And don't get me wrong, I started this business when it was just me out in the field collecting data the purest way. Do you know what I mean? Doing the observations, doing all the great things. And that is the way that I've been brought up on this, you know, so I can see why it's difficult for some people to be able to maybe get their head around a change in general about how things have always been done. But I think we have to also be realistic in well, maybe not, it's not happening now because we still deploy that model, but we still have to think about the future and how tech and how we can make it easier for companies to be able to get this information and data. And how does that mean our roles will potentially change? And it's not that we're going to be out of a job, because I think the way that I see it is that the detect, solve, improve model becomes even more refined, because the detect is still done, but just maybe in a different way. And the solve part, essentially, we don't have robots that can go change a bearing. We don't have robots that can go lubricate a bearing. We don't have that element of actual action that's required, probably to the 20% of actions that are derived from the 100% of detect what's coming in. Does that make sense?
Even if you put sensors on everything, they're all going to need servicing at some point. Someone's still got to walk around and do the inspections.
Yeah, and the PM's inspections as well.
They still have to be done. It's just
the different way of collection.
It's a different way of collecting. And also when it comes down to, you know, doing analysis, it's about looking at the efficiencies of, you know, you might find as you're walking around doing vibration analysis that 5 out of 100 assets you have to stop at for a little bit longer and do a bit more of an in-depth understanding of what's going on, because the data comes back and goes, it's a bit abnormal. But the difficulty is, and the facts of the matter, unfortunately, is there are not enough people and skilled people to do this as well in this country.
This is what we're finding.
Because this is the issue with why data is now, and AI is seeming such a, not only benefit, but also in a situation where...
scalable option, though, Will. Because if tomorrow, I mean, again, we've grown, I mean, we put a LinkedIn picture out the other day of 7 of us standing in the picture, and it just seems like yesterday was just me. Right. And this is me growing at the fastest possible rate that we could by training people and getting people on. And it's a very long process. I mean, I think when I learned my trade, it was, you know, I wasn't out there really doing what I needed to do for, you know, at least a couple of years.
You consider even myself, you know, we've been doing this nearly 10 years myself, Will probably a similar, if not a bit more. There's still people I talk to today that have been doing this for longer than I am alive.
Yeah, I know, exactly. We have to respect them people because they've taught us a lot along the way. You know,
and
what I mean?
It's just on that basis, you know, it takes a long time to develop our skills and learn from all these different things.
It does. It's not easy. It's not as if we can go find someone who can do the job tomorrow. And they are out there, but generally they're probably in a job.
And when you look at
that... or if they're looking for a job, it's usually because they're changing, or maybe they've moved somewhere, or they're looking for some form of change or whatever. It's not, there's not even really right now an active apprenticeship that allows people to have a pool of people that are coming into this industry. And that's something that we're really trying to be able to change as well, because regardless of how technology, you know, evolves, and regardless of how much that will take hold, we still need people to be able to understand what the technology is doing and really, you know, gather that information as well.
When you look at it on a person level, you know, we've got Jamie, he looks after the North, just done his Cat 3. Well done, Jamie. Passed that.
Congratulations, buddy.
And he's one of our senior analysts. Now, Jamie's resource of time, let's say 8 hours a day, is spent walking around one site on Monday collecting, I don't know, 100 assets. Of those 100 assets, 70 of them were okay and didn't require any further action. The other, I don't know, 10, 15 or whatever the total will be, maybe required some additional analysis back when he got home in the afternoon, or he looked at something when he was there. And he does that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. As a percentage of the total assets that he's tested in the week, he may only be actually reviewing 10% further to add recommendations to the customer.
And essentially, it's kind of almost inefficient, isn't it? Essentially, out of all of the data you test in a day with them assets, the ones that are okay, you don't really need to analyze, but you had to collect the data to know that they didn't need to be analyzed.
Yeah.
And this is where I think this tech can evolve. And I'm not saying that, oh, every asset's going to have a members-based sensor. No, there's going to be still a structured way of understanding the criticalities, understanding what type of technique is needed, whether that be, for example, we're talking AquaM here because we obviously use AquaM equipment, MVX wired continuous system on really high critical
gas compressors
that can collect, you know, do just as powerful measurements as our Falcons can, but all of the time. That, you know, you may have a requirement for that. But that, again, you don't want to put that across every single asset on site either, because it's not cost effective to do so. But then you'll have this level of like, right, you know, once we've done the criticality studies and understand really where to focus the attention on, there's going to be a mixture of technology and maybe even a little bit of handheld once every, you know, 3 months if required or needs be on some of our assets. But you may still need to be able to, especially on the mass asset set where you've got the MEM sensors, for example, is when you do see a change, is that you get someone to come in troubleshoot it. Yep. Do you know what I mean? And they'll be there with their analyzer, and as well, regardless whether we're on site doing the troubleshooting, there still also needs to be an effective PPM strategy of making sure that all of the other things that, and again, this should be down into risk mitigation of understanding what VA can find, what it can't find, what are the risks of you know, not walking by your machines, what are you going to miss? Oil leaks. Do you know what I mean? Sensor checks and all these other things. And once you've done that risk mitigation, is then make sure that that's filled in, because none of this will work if not every element in terms of reliability structure has been thought about. And this is what concerns me, where we go into site and the buzzword is, yeah, wireless sensors, let's get them on everything. There's no goal. There's no strategy. And it's just like, throw them on, because that's what people are doing. And effectively, when we do get the failures or something is missed, it's not because it doesn't work. It's because the strategy has not been formulated from the plan above with reliability in mind.
If you set that all in place and you have, let's look at the most gold standard little factory, I don't know, we've got a little chocolate bar line or something like that, and you look at, right, we've got Bob, he's head of engineering and he's gone through his ARP journey with Mobius or whatever, and he understands that each asset on that line needs to go through a FAMICA process, or he needs to understand how he's going to maintain it, and he's decided that what we're going to do is we're going to, I don't know, employ maintain reliability, they're going to come in and they're going to put a series of wireless vibration sensors to monitor their assets from a vibration point of view. Maybe we've built a lubrication schedule and done a training day with his engineers and they're doing that. And we're doing a few other bits, but we've decided, okay, this machine's really critical, so we're going to put an MVX on it, and we've got all the bearing information because Bob's really supportive and he's got all that information filed away. And then we're going to put wireless sensors on everything, and we've got all of that bearing information as well, because again, you know, they've got all the drawings sitting to the side because it's well categorized. And they're leading the charge in terms of asset reliability, and they've got everything set out for them
in place.
They've got a planner and scheduler, and they support the work in place, and they've got their CMS system. We know that in reality that's not the case, but that's where everyone should be striving for. But we've got all of this in place. What we can then act upon that is for us and Detect, Solve, Improve. This is where I feel like we're going in terms of almost like a Formula One team. This is how I see it. So we've got the engineering team and they're producing it. And maybe in this instance, you know, we already know worldwide there's a shortage of engineers. So Bob's running a bit of a lean team of two engineers that manage the shift. They can't do any big changes, but they've got spares available and we do their repairs for them as well as and when. That's the Solve part of maintain. We support customers with repairs on site and in our workshop. Where the sensors come in is we're getting the data fed back to our central location. We maybe have a quarterly visit with Bob or a monthly visit to pop in and check in to make sure he's okay. And we do a walk around. Maybe we do a PM for them once a month as well, just as a visual. But fundamentally, the data is coming back to us, and then our senior engineers that are trained aren't wasting time collecting data. All they're doing is focusing their time on analysing and looking at the data. Jamie's in the office. He's analysing this chocolate line. You can see there's an issue on one of the assets, but he's got a really good relationship with site. So he gives one of the engineers a call. They walk over, have a little listen. We've done work before with a camera company called Texo where they've got cameras and we can live stream.
Yeah, maybe a bit of that as well.
You can see that remotely.
Or he might just come visit site and just do some data checks to make sure and, you know, all the rest of it.
Maybe that shift engineer goes to site and goes, oh, Jamie, that does sound a bit rough. And Jamie can see in his data, it's a MEMS-based sensor, sounds a bit rough, but he wants to do some advanced troubleshooting. So he rings up Bob and he says, hey, Bob, I've got an issue we've seen come through this morning. I'm going to deploy and come see you if that's okay. All built within the service contract. But the idea is rather than being there month on month on month, we will analyze the data on a daily basis. And then if an abnormality happens that we're not happy with, we would deploy an engineer. So then an engineer leaves site to go and have a look at that specific issue, gets to site, maybe does some advanced troubleshooting, identifies there's an issue with the motor. And then the next day we can have an engineering team go in, swap the motor out and liaise with production. And then we can do and have a review as to why it failed in the first place.
Of course. And I think this is the perfect model, the ideal model in terms of A, efficiency, B, time to be able to get to the solution in the quickest way possible with the most amount of data. But remember, this is reliant on the sensor cost being at a cost, essentially. You know,
it's not just sensor cost. Well, not though, reliant but like, on it. Like, it's but, not. It's
we have to be careful here when I say that because essentially, just because you can get it cheaper, is that the reason you do it? No. Because you have to look at the value in terms of the risk as well of doing monthly VA, because it's a risk just even doing monthly. Because how many times have we seen no change between visits and it's just gone absolutely... You put a post out the other day, didn't you, for one of our customers? And, you know, they heard it, luckily, but when you got called in to take that data again,
it was gone.
It was red. The whole thing was red, and the data before was completely green. So in between that time, it wouldn't have lasted. So this is the other thing as well about, okay, most of the time, you could say most of the time with, you know, asterisks, you should be able to get it, but it should good enough.
But and the cost one is a really difficult one as well, because we say, we want the cost to come down a little bit and to make it on a mass scale. You know, if you have like one sensor, I don't know, let's say they're £300 and you put, I don't know, I'm going to do terrible maths here, 100 on, you know, suddenly you're at 300,000? Maybe, I don't know, terrible maths in my head there. But you're very, once you scale at that level, you're getting very high at that point, right? So on a large scale, that becomes quite costly, which is when we look at it and go, well, it'd be nicer if this was a bit cheaper. We could put it on mass a lot more. But then the culture change part that has to come with that, which is to look at it and be like, well, what's the value?
Yeah. Because, and why are we doing this? Why are we doing it anyway? You know what I mean?
We work with a number of biogas sites. They have gas compressors. Well, the gas compressor on its own is £60,000. Now, when you look at an online system to monitor that 24/7, it certainly isn't going to cost £60,000, but it could mitigate that. Oh, it's not going to stop it being spent, but it's going to allow us to monitor a lot more regularly to prevent the downtime. But even with the downtime, and if it was to catastrophically fail, it's still going to cost £60,000. We're just monitoring it a lot more accurately.
So, yeah, of course. And well, I think the idea is that because you're monitoring it every day, you'd find it before it causes secondary damage or the cost of the actual asset itself. But again, that still has to be put into a risk model. Do you know what I mean? That still has to be put into a return on investment model. For again, a lot of people will buy only on the returns. Well, is there value in that action? Yeah. And that's generally done on a return on investment model, which is very difficult to do when there's a lot of subjectivity around worst case scenarios. And look, we've done this before with cost avoidances, and you know, it can be difficult because it's like, well, what's the worst that could happen? Well, bloody hell, it could fly out of the building and wreck another 2, 3, 4. Do you know what I mean? There's so much more to it, you know, in terms of understanding what the true cost of failure is until, and you know, if you've had failures in the past, I suppose you've got data there to be able to go yeah. by. But then the next failure that happens could be a lot worse or could be a lot less. You know, yeah. so you've got all this subjectivity around it. But I think what the main thing to remember with anything we do is if we can eliminate it, why are we not trying to anyway? Do you know what I mean? And I think that, again, that's culture. That's not doing something on the basis of a return on investment or money. It's then looking at the whole reliability spectrum and saying, well, does it help the whole of our culture and what we're trying to do? Does it improve health and safety? Does it have... You know, does it allow us to be more sustainable? Does it allow all these elements that are attributed to reliability? That's where we need to start thinking. Yep. Because if not, we're just always going to be trying to base models around return on investment on production and like one level kind of actions that result to one goal that don't really have a look at the whole picture of reliability. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Wow. Incredible discussion that.
I feel like there's so much more to talk about and I kind of want to get everyone else's input on it, see what your guys
thought. Well, we might do that. We've had, since we put out that post, we've had other people very interested in talking about this.
And companies, I'm really.
Other companies, yeah. And I'm really interested to see what they've got to say.
Everyone's view.
Because I don't think, you know, me and you, like with our limited knowledge, mate, I mean, you know, yeah. we are in this game every day, but... We are, you know, we have our limitations in terms yeah. of what we can say. So what I'm really interested in is seeing if, you know, what other opinions are on this. Yeah, are we right? Are we wrong? Are we completely off the mark? I don't know. I think we kind of talk from our heart on our sleeves a little bit as this podcast. I think the reason why it's been so successful is because we're not scared to say what we feel and what we think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's got to be a level of authenticity when we're talking about these subjects. And we have to be careful as well because we understand the implications of what this technology can do, even to our business.
Mm.
You know what I mean? This is something that we've built. And I love to grow a massive team across the UK, whatever, but it's not been easy, this. You know, this has not been easy.
Is, you know, this is the direction that technology is moving in. And the bus is moving.
Do we get on it? Or do we just...
If you don't get on it, though...
Pretend it doesn't exist, you know? We've got to be able to... We've got to have these discussions now. This is why it's important. Because I feel a lot of the time, when somebody hears something that potentially can damage their makeup or asset or thing that they've built so hard in a certain way, people don't want to hear it. But then that's no good either, because if you choose to ignore it and be ignorant to the fact that tech is here, and this was me as well to a degree. There's a lot of years when I'm seeing all this and I'm
trying
like,
to convince you for a while.
Well, you know, I always knew it was coming.
You did know it was
coming. I did know it was coming. But again, it just, the thing is with it as well, sometimes it's difficult to gauge though, because, yeah. you know, a lot of this tech is here and I'm aware of it. But then I go back to certain customers where we're doing stuff and it's like, they're not even at the start of anything.
I think
so. It's a bit like, well, how does that technology even fit in here if they don't understand even the value of someone going around doing a handheld collection? Do you know what I mean? So, you know, I do believe there's a huge gap between culture and tech. And I think it's going to be a difficult job to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
Because we can't take the culture quick enough to where the tech's going.
No.
This is the scary thing. We don't want to be in UK manufacturing where we've got all this beautiful technology and we're still being reactive. Do you know what I mean? That's yeah. a failing in terms of us being that powerhouse of manufacturing and moving towards a more sustainable future.
I think a good one is like to look at it is it was you talking with Patrice at Aquem.
Yeah.
I can't remember which industry, whether it was Asia. It was one of the Asian countries that almost changed overnight to Industry 4.0.
Yeah, it was just literally like, boom.
And so it may happen like that in the UK, but I fear that if we don't move ahead with this and start looking in this direction, we're going to start falling behind as yeah. a country.
And I fear as well, we have to be careful with that. If it is a quick change like that, that the strategies of reliability and all that knowledge is in place. And that's, I think... For us, it's not hard to get a condition monitoring program going, but for us, it's difficult to have this conversation with some of these companies about reliability because the KPI measures are not really, they're not measured on certain things that need to be driven. So does that mean we need a new approach to that strategy? And how do we then inspire people to make that approach? You know, this comes from the top down. We've talked about reliability before and it all feeds from that stem as well. So all of this does tie under that umbrella. And if we can really inspire people to, and keep talking on this podcast, keep raising awareness about it, keep talking about it every single time we go to site and all the rest of it and try to keep the battle going, as long as we all come together, regardless of what company you work for, regardless of what you do, regardless of, you know, what position or what you have, as long as we have that same philosophy, then we will move this industry forward. We will. And it will go to a better place. And I think that's what we need to do. On that note.
Sounds good.
Thank you guys for tuning in again. I feel emotionally drained after that one. It was a good discussion, great discussion. We may be extending this and getting other people's opinion on it. We might have a few episodes where we ask other people, but I thought it was really important that me and Will just flesh it out first before we talk to anyone else about it. So thank you guys for tuning in. And yeah, keep your eyes peeled for the next podcast. We're going to probably put another few polls out because in between these podcasts, or we might go back to the previous poll, Will, and see what was the next one in line. And we might do that. I don't know. We'll come up with some ideas. But thank you guys for tuning in. Take care.